Hello there. Today is Wednesday, May 30th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, new indications that a meeting between President Trump and North Korea's leader will happen.
The United States continues to actively prepare for President Trump's expected summit with leader Kim in Singapore.
Starbucks closes all of its U.S. stores for anti-racial bias training. Also ahead, a South Korean boy band's music is shooting up the charts. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will meet later this week with the North Korean four-star general in New York for talks related to a planned summit between President Donald Trump and North Korea's leader, according to the White House. State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert.
North Korean Vice Chairman of the Central Committee Kim Yong-chul is arriving in New York and will meet with Secretary Pompeo later this week. We also have a U.S. delegation meeting with a North Korean delegation in the DMZ.
Additional meetings are planned this week. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Stephen Norper, senior director of the Korea Society, about this being the highest-ranking North Korean official to visit the U.S. since 2000.
That's right. So this is significant in the sense that there hasn't been this near-most visit. I recall that earlier visit in 2000, and it was a time when U.S. officials gave serious heed to North Korean concerns and were trying to find ways to move forward. So perhaps this will usher in some sort of communication that enables the Singapore summit and the beginning of a process that could lead to denuclearization and addressing the many other concerns the United States has with North Korea.
President Trump tweeted on Tuesday that this was a solid response to his letter about North Korea's open hostility. What do you think?
Indeed, it is a response in the sense that South Korean President Moon Jae-in met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un on Saturday. There was a lot of diplomatic flurry after it looked like the summit would be canceled as recently as the end of this last week. So clearly this is meant as a way to try to solve or a solution to this impasse in negotiation. And so Trump feels it's in response to that. So be it. But it is a process where we need to recognize that were it not for the South Korean leader, the summit probably would not have taken place.
Well, this summit may still not take place. The U.S. is not confirmed that the summit is definitely on, although it says preparations are apace. It may not actually take place on June 12. What is your feeling about whether this meeting will actually go off?
Well, the White House spokeswoman has said that it's likely it will go off for June 12. And if it doesn't go off specifically on that date, she suggested in the immediate days after. That said, seems to be a process that's unusual. It's not regular diplomacy. It's not a process where there's been a series of talks among working level and senior officials that lead to a meeting of two heads of state. This is much more like a meeting of CEOs, and it's been unwieldy. So a lot of emotion, a lot of personality involved, and clearly in this most recent break, one where the South Koreans had to resume a role of playing intermediary and peace broker. So let's see if they get them to the table. I tend to think at this point the stakes are high, the preparations seem to be in place. The U.S. delegation has been to Pyongyang. U.S. delegation is in Singapore. The North Koreans now have sent Kim to New York, and he'll be meeting with Pompeo, and the North Koreans have also sent Kim Jong-un's chief of staff to Singapore. So it seems that all the planks are in place by way of their preparations logistically.
Of course, if these talks go off, denuclearization will be the top agenda item. You know Siegfried Hecker of Stanford University, former director of U.S. Los Alamos Weapons Laboratory in New Mexico. He said denuclearization, even if it goes off, may take 15 years.
And that's basically the line that the North Koreans have said, that denuclearization is a longer process and that were things to work within 10 or 20 years. That coincides with Sig Heckler's expert opinion, and his is really among the very top of anyone who's had exposure to North Korea's capabilities. He saw the highly enriched uranium technology in 2010. He's been very relevant in terms of what capacity North Korea actually has. It will be a long road and a very complicated one, and there will no doubt be many setbacks. And the North Koreans have indicated they'll not be involved in any type of Libya-style shutdown. So it may be longer term, it may be incremental, but it seems that the White House is pushing for at least a dramatic move by way of some rollback on the weaponry early on in the process. It may not be an ideal process, but denuclearization remains the U.S. and international community's priority.
At the same time, the U.S. government Tuesday released an alert with technical details about a series of cyber attacks stretching back at least to 2009, blaming it squarely on North Korea. So its cyber warfare efforts continue.
Well, cyber warfare is an area of tremendous concern. North Koreans have elevated their capability. They've gone from a second-tier country to really now a first-tier country in terms of the cyber threats they pose to the international financial system, the way that they have dickered about with the SWIFT system, to South Korea, where they have attacked banks and businesses, and they're suspected of much more involvement. Of course, everyone has heard about the Sony attack, and the emissary who has just been sent to New York, Kim Jong-chol, is one of the individuals who was linked to that attack taking place. It also explains why, part of the reason why he was put on sanctions list, because of his supposed involvement in intelligence and other nefarious activity. What it really says to the international community is that we have a lot to deal with North Korea. Cyber capabilities, conventional threat, of course the nuclear and missile threat, which is foremost, chemical and biological weapons, human rights. The list is very long and it's very challenging.
That's Stephen Norper, Senior Director of the Korea Society. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Nigeria's Safe School Programs is aiming to ensure security amid Boko Haram threats. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will meet with top North Korean officials in New York. Search ends for Malaysian flight missing for 4 years. And Gaza militants strike Israel, drawing Israeli retaliation. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app, this is International Edition. The American Broadcasting Company canceled Roseanne Barr's new TV show after she posted racist remarks about Valerie Jarrett, an African-American who served as White House advisor to President Barack Obama. Barr tweeted Tuesday that Jared is a product of the Muslim Brotherhood and the Planet of the Apes. It stirred enormous backlash, which was later followed up by Barr tweeting an apology. It happened on the same day that Starbucks closed its more than 8,000 U.S. stores for anti-bias training, weeks after police arrested two African-American men in a store in the northeastern city of Philadelphia. Joining us now is Janet Crenshaw-Smith, president of the Ivy Planning Group, which does diversity and training worldwide. Thank you for being with us. So what happened at Starbucks, especially now with social media, was obviously something the company took very seriously.
From the very top, they are immediately decided to do something. And I do like that. I think it's really important for the very top of an organization to put their money where their mouth is and take an action.
What does the training for something like this look like, closing all their stores?
My understanding of what they did is actually not what a typical unconscious bias training would look like. So it probably has some of the elements. First of all, it is awareness around what unconscious bias is, and particularly a key learning point that everybody has it. And I think that's one of the important things to clear up. Because there's a misunderstanding that only some people have bias. All of us do.
So letting people be aware that they have bias to begin with, no matter who they are. And then how do you get in touch with that part of yourself that has the unconscious bias to be able to recognize it before you do something regretful?
There's a site online that I think the Starbucks employees were sent to, and most people are sent to at some point. It's called the Implicit Association Test. It gives you some insights into your bias. This is a somewhat controversial test because people question its validity. But no matter what, it does make you pause and think, wait a minute, you know, maybe I do have a bias. We also use examples for people so that they can start to understand, well, you know, that is true. I did make some assumptions about people and groups of people. So there are lots of ways to get at it, but you have to start by making it personal, for helping people to understand, I do make assumptions about people.
Are there any strategies for improving workplace culture in this regard?
Yes, there are lots of strategies. First of all, to help people to understand that when people have biases, it rolls up, it combines to organizational systems having bias. And so we have to uncover the ways it shows up and do something about it. So an example, let's say that we're going to be hiring for a position and we say we require 15 years of experience. Well, that seems really normal. On the surface, that's fine. But then when we stop and ask ourselves, why are we assuming that with experience comes the skills that you need? Does that mean we have a bias for more experienced people? Sometimes that translates into a certain generation of people that we're targeting. Instead, let's say, what's the real requirement? What's the skills requirement? And let anybody take the test. And if they test into the job, let's go for it.
Are there any red flags that you look for when there are issues in the workplace that people are taught to be aware of that before they become problems?
One big red flag is actually looking at the data. If you look at data and you see that there are huge gaps in the kinds of talent that is available versus the kinds of talent that you see at certain levels or in certain jobs, that's a red flag that says we need to take a deeper look at this. For example, if you walk into a room and it's all male,
right?
A room of managers, for example, you've got to ask yourself, well, why aren't there any women here? You know, if we believe that talent comes in all packages, in this case, in all gender packages, then why aren't there any women in the room? What happened? You have to at least ask yourself. And particularly in 2018, women have the ability to do just about any job. So why wouldn't they be in the room? You just have to pause and ask yourself.
When it comes to the situation at Starbucks with these two African-American young men, what went wrong there? What happened? Did someone just look at them and make an assumption based on their color of their skin?
It's hard to know exactly what went wrong there, but the one thing that I would ask is, why didn't somebody say something? And so that's one of the key messages that we like to send in training, is that there are three key roles in situations. It's the person who does something, it's the person who's on the recipient of something happening, and then there's the observer, the bystander. And in this case, when it is a business situation, it would have been great if the employee's colleague had said something. So, you know, why are we doing that? And so what great organizations do is they give people permission to speak up if something just feels wrong. In fact, we don't just give you permission to speak up. Great leaders actually set the expectation that you'll speak up. And when you have a diverse workforce with everybody knowing that they're expected to speak up, it cuts out so much of things that happen.
All right. We appreciate your perspective. Janet Crenshaw-Smith, president of the Ivy Planning Group, which does diversity and inclusion training strategy worldwide. President Donald Trump contended Tuesday that prosecutors investigating the 2016 campaign's links to Russia will be meddling in November's congressional elections. Trump offered no explanation how he thinks the legal team of special counsel Robert Mueller would interfere with the voting. In a string of Twitter comments, Trump made no mention of the conclusion last week by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that U.S. officials expect continued efforts by Russia to interfere with the November congressional elections, just as the U.S. intelligence community concluded it did in the presidential election 2 years ago. Joining us now to discuss is Robert Deitz, former special counsel of the National Security Agency. Thank you for being with us, sir. What do you think is going on here with these tweets?
To my mind, what Mr. Trump is doing is attempting to cast doubt on the integrity of the American justice system. You know, he wouldn't say, well, not altogether, but he would say, you know, just about this particular investigation. But the fact is that he has been basically nonstop, almost since the inaugural, in attacking the integrity of the Department of Justice and the FBI and, of course, Mr. Mueller. And I think that's a terribly dangerous thing to do in a democratic society, because if you keep up these kinds of statements long enough, then some people at least are going to begin to believe it. And that That's not going to do our country any good.
Well, it certainly would appear that according to polls, people are starting to have less confidence in the Russia investigation, despite a number of indictments and guilty pleas.
Yeah, here's my theory behind this. Mr. Mueller is acting in a completely professional way in that none of his cases is being tried in the press. That is, when Mr. Trump talks about witch hunts and so on, Mr. Mueller doesn't have his press person come out and say, "Witch hunt? Wait a minute, I just got 19 indictments." There's none of that kind of thing. And I'm sure it must be incredibly tempting for Mr. Mueller, but he's a thorough professional and won't do it. So therefore, at this stage, all you have is one side speaking about the witch hunt and so on and so forth. I think what will end that, not only end the criticism, but end people's sympathy with the Trump argument by an indictment of, one of the key people in the administration.
What about the silence from Republicans? Are they somehow enabling him to continue to do this?
Yeah, I think they are. It's rough asking politicians to act their conscience and not their party. But I think there are times when one really needs to do that.
It's interesting because a longtime Democratic strategist, in response to the president talking about Mueller potentially meddling in the midterms, this Democratic strategist said, well, the president of the United States would rather you believe there's domestic meddling in the U.S. elections, in the next U.S. elections, with no evidence than there was Russian meddling in the last one, despite incontrovertible evidence.
Right. There's another problem with this meddling in the midterm election theory, and that is, what should a prosecutor, an investigator like Mr. Mueller do? Say, okay, look, I'm going to call time out so that the voters will have no idea about what's happening so as not to influence the election. I mean, the fact is that investigations often take more than a year or two. The Whitewater investigation certainly took longer than that. Now, having said all that, my instinct, and this is nothing but an instinct, is that Mr. Mueller is going to come out with something important well before the election.
It would also look like Mr. Trump's attorney, Rudy Giuliani, seems to be talking about how there's evidence now that the whole investigation was started on false premises.
Yeah.
And it's illegitimate. Are they setting the stage to try to fire Mueller? And is it feasible that the Trump administration could end the Mueller investigation at this point in the game and just literally put a stop to it?
I don't think so. What you're talking about is what he is calling Spygate, hoping it picks up traction in the press parallel Watergate. Realistically, I don't think he can fire Mr. Mueller. I think that even for Republicans, I think that would be a bridge too far.
So what would happen?
Well, I think at that stage, then you're beginning to look a lot like impeachment.
All right. Robert Deitz, former special counsel of the National Security Agency, currently a professor at the Schar School of Public Policy at George Mason University. Thank you for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues. Thousands of students continue to attend the University of Maiduguri in northeastern Nigeria, despite at least a dozen attacks by the Boko Haram insurgency since the start of 2017. Chika Odura reports from Maiduguri on how the university has been able to stay open and, some would say, even thrive amidst the constant danger.
At the University of Maiduguri's radio station, DJs not only have to play music, they also try to keep students calm.
We make it a priority to do that, to keep them positive. Of course, to try and stay relaxed, focus on their studies.
That's because the university of 20,000 students is in the city where the terrorist group Boko Haram was formed and where it continues to launch deadly attacks. Throughout Boko Haram's 9-year war against the Nigerian government, the university was never targeted until January 2017. Tasiu Hassan remembers that very first attack.
I was on campus, actually. On that very day, even me too, I have examination, but the university management had to cancel all the examination. I found myself in a very, very terrible situation, in such a way that I have even started thinking of going back home.
But he stayed, like many of his classmates. Since then, the university has been hit at least 12 times, university officials told VOA. Suicide bombers have detonated explosives at the school on separate incidents. About a dozen members of the geology department were kidnapped in June. The university is the most prestigious and largest public educational institution in northeastern Nigeria. The students are defying Boko Haram's message, which denounces Western education as sinful. Today, students are taking their final exams. The university has never closed for a single day throughout Boko Haram's insurgency.
To show how resilient we are, to show how much sacrifice we are making, and that is the true reflection of the Maiduguri spirit. We are here because we have a responsibility to keep the system going. Somebody has to be around to do the job, no matter how bad the situation is.
Last year, authorities dug a 27-kilometer-long trench around the university's eastern perimeter, which faces Cameroon, where many Boko Haram insurgents operate. The trench is designed to slow down Boko Haram fighters who often invade cities on motorcycle. Every day, sniffer dogs carry out inspections. They're looking out for bomb chemicals and weapons. No other public Nigerian university in the region has this level of security. It's why Esther Clement continues to go to school here.
Even though there's insurgency, we are secured. As you can see, even before you come to the gate of the to the gate one, there are securities here and there. At the gate of the hostel, there are securities. Even when there is bomb blast, they call us to calm us down. They secure the whole hostels. We don't go out.
Despite the obvious risk, the student population is growing, and current students say the school is actually getting stronger in the fight against Boko Haram. Chika Odua for VOA News, Maiduguri, Nigeria.
Well, a hot new single from a Korean boy band is shooting up the charts. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with all the details.
Today, we are going international, Sarah. Today, we're looking at a band who have done something that has never been done before in Billboard history. The first K-pop band to have a number one album on the Billboard charts, BTS. They are right now the rage. Everybody is talking about this Korean 7-member boy band who performed on the Billboard Award show recently, and they won a Billboard Award for Top Social Artist. They're on tour in the U.S. promoting their third album. Album number 3 is called Love Yourself, Tear. And as I said, it's the first K-pop band album to hit number 1 on Billboard. They started back in 2013. They called themselves at the time the Bangtan Boys. They've shortened it, obviously, for the international appeal to BTS. The group consists of V, Suga, Jin, Jungkook, RM, Jimin, and J-Hope. And they are just the rage right now. So we're going to listen to their brand new song, which is getting some attention and airplay here in the United States. And the song is called Fake Love. Here are BTS.
Speaking of K-pop, a number of years ago, there was that huge hit, Gangnam Style.
Gangnam Style, and he's saying it was bilingual. Much of it was in English by a very famous Psy, who's very famous in Korea. But this is the first boy band from Korea, K-pop boy band, because K-pop is huge around the world. In fact, this particular group have released 3 albums in Korean, but 3 in Japanese. And there just seems to be a fascination right now with Asian music and what's going on in the Asian music scene. The new album, Love Yourself Tear, is the first foreign language album to hit number 1 in over 12 years. It's the first K-pop album ever, but we had a foreign language album 12 years ago reach number 1 on Billboard. And these guys have won many, many awards going back to their very first album, Too Cool for School. They got New Artist of the Year at a variety of different Asian award shows. The second album was Wings in 2016. It became their first million-selling album, sold over 1.5 million copies, got them the Artist of the Year award at the Asian Music Awards. These guys are here in the United States right now. In fact, Time Magazine has named them one of the 25 most influential people on the internet, because these guys have attracted so many followers, hence the, you know, top social media act at the Billboard Awards show. Their fans call them the Army. They refer to themselves as the Army, BTS's fan club. And I'm going to try and get them on Border Crossing, because I'd like to talk to these guys. I don't know how much English they speak. Uh-huh. When they accepted the award at the Billboard show, they were kind of very reluctant to say a whole lot.
Right.
But, you know, maybe we can get them on VOA, and that would be wonderful. But right now, they're the rage, and they're it.
And we have a VOA Korean service. They could probably help you out.
There you go. That would be wonderful. And I know, by the way, last year, Guinness Book of World Records revealed BTS had earned a spot in the 2018 edition for having the world's most Twitter engagements for a group at over 500 million.
Wow.
So congratulations to BTS. They're here to stay.
Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossing.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The darknet is a part of the internet that is not easily searchable and requires specific software configurations or authorization for access. Entire websites can be set up on the darknet whose contents, as well as all connections made to the websites, are encrypted, allowing users to operate and access the sites anonymously. Exploitation of the darknet by transnational organized crime is a growing phenomenon and is a serious threat to all our national and economic securities, said Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs James Walsh. Indeed, criminals use the darknet to facilitate child sex exploitation and to engage in illegal sales of stolen identity information, guns, toxic chemicals, explosives, and, of course, illegal drugs. Notably, the darknet has created a new drug trafficking paradigm, allowing users to order and receive products like fentanyl through the mail. This means they bypass traditional drug trafficking routes and organizations. Payment is often made through cryptocurrencies that can further protect anonymity, said James Walsh. Obviously, there is a pressing need to address this criminal activity. But by their very nature, criminal marketplaces hosted on the darknet are extremely challenging to locate and their users to identify, meaning that skilled law enforcement and extensive multilateral cooperation are needed for any successful investigation. In a powerful step to curb illicit activity on the dark net, last year, U.S. and Dutch law enforcement led the coordinated shutdown of 2 of the top 5 darknet marketplaces, Alphabay and Hansa Markets, in a coordinated international operation by 7 countries and Europol. At its peak, Alphabay had over 350,000 listings for illicit goods and services. During its lifetime, the site appears to have had over 10,000 active vendors, 400,000 active buyers, and have completed around 10 million transactions worth approximately $750 million. Hansa had approximately 2,100 active vendors and 60,000 active buyers and was growing. Deputy Assistant Secretary Walsh noted the importance of international agreements and conventions in fighting this emerging scourge. The more countries take action on cybercrime and working together, the more effective we will be. It is important that we prevent the creation of safe havens that can be exploited by criminals wherever they be, he said. We also urge continued focus on technical assistance building. For our part, the United States is ramping up our foreign assistance programs to help developing nations build their capacity to pursue darknet criminals.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.